for several years now, small distilleries have come up all over our region. And to learn about them, we consulted an expert. In fact, the expert, our friend and contributor Kathleen Purvis, who is the food editor at the Charlotte Observer. Kathleen and I have been buds for a while, and I was delighted when I heard about her plan to visit the small distilleries of the South and then to write a book about them.
We ended up doing 6 trails that cover 11 southern states. Mm-hmm. I went to 54 distilleries in 13 months.
For her book, Kathleen plotted what she calls 6 liquor trails that lead through the South. Who wouldn't want to follow a liquor trail? But most importantly, she documented how our region's craft distillers are creating new southern traditions in booze, because it ain't all about the bourbon anymore. And she mapped all this out so people can visit exactly where those new traditions are being created as they're being created. All of this work is featured in her 2018 book, Distilling the South, A Guide to Southern Craft Liquors and the People Who Make Them. And our friend Sean Chavis of the Folklore Podcast talked with Kathleen and Charlotte.
When we started out with craft brewing, there was a reason for craft brewing, because there was terrible American beer. I mean, let's face it, American beer for a long time was nasty, and it was watered, and it was not that great. And Europe had all this great beer, and then we started having people making great American beer. We already had great American liquor. You know, it ain't like America was making bad whiskey.
Right.
So you have to go to these people and say, why on earth do you think that you can make something better than, you know, a Jack Daniels or a Woodford Reserve or a Maker's Mark? You know, why would you stake your whole life on trying to do that? And that was one of the questions I really wanted to get to people. And I found a variety of answers, but they all had sort of in common the same thing. I really, you know, I was sitting around with my friends, I was drinking this, I was thinking how much I loved it, and we started saying, gee, well, I wonder if you can make this. You know, I wonder if I could do this. The other thing that really was, I think, a driver, and I've seen this in several areas of the food world, is around when we had the big crash in 2008, a lot of people were either offered buyouts or they lost their jobs or they were coming out of business school but the banks weren't hiring. And so what we've seen all over craft food are all these people who came out of school, needed something to do, a job, and they decided instead of just having a job, they wanted to make something that was theirs. And so we've seen this explosion in craft bread and craft cheese and charcuterie and, you know, all of these different products. And this is really a part of the same thing. This is a craft food just like everything else in the craft food movement.
There are several things that really jumped out to me, like the limoncello.
I started off the book with the limoncello.
Yeah.
Who knew you would find them making limoncello from lemons that are growing in West Virginia?
Lemons in Virginia, I was like,
I know,
really?
I know. It's the first page of the book has a picture mm-hmm. that I took inside this greenhouse on the side of a mountain about 15 minutes from Harper's Ferry. So it's like northern West Virginia.
Wow.
And I'm surrounded by lemon trees. And I'm standing there just kind of doing it. What? how can this be? But yeah, it was a couple who had gone to Italy to the husband's great-great aunt was going to be beatified by the Catholic Church. And wow. So they went to Rome for the ceremony. And while they were in Rome, they got a bottle of limoncello, fell in love with it, came back to America, started buying American limoncellos and realizing they weren't that good, because they tend to, in America, most of the American limoncellos are made with pith that they use. They use machine to get it off, and it takes too much of the pith off with the zest, and so it makes it bitter. And so they wanted to do it by hand and see if they could make something as good as what you find in Italy. And now they have a line of 10 different cordials they do. It's called Bloomery Distillery. And they have these sweet shine cordials, and so they do like black walnut, and they've got, oh man, they got some crazy flavors, Hawaiian ginger. It's a blast of a place to go visit.
Nice.
But it's tucked up in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I was literally like, I go to pull off the road to drive up there, and I'm looking at this dirt road going uphill, and then you get halfway up, and there's a sign that says, yes, just accelerate, you'll make it, keep going.
Keep going,
we're up here.
Almost there.
Cool. Yeah.
What was the most surprising thing you found?
Man, I found people who were doing expressions of their lives. One of my favorite places that I went to is in Georgia. It's about 2 hours south of the Atlanta airport, and it is called Richland Rum, and mm-hmm. it's in Richland, Georgia. And it's a couple who, she's They're both Dutch. He came over here as a child, as a baby. She was 18, was raised by a farmer in Holland. And so when she always wanted to go back to the land, she always wanted to grow things. He was fascinated by sugarcane and rum because of the West Indies. You know, the Dutch started all of that in the West Indies. Mm-hmm. And so he was very interested in history. And so they were going to just grow sugarcane for their own amusement and make rum just for themselves as a hobby. And they decided to do it legally, so they got a liquor license. And the mayor of this little abandoned town, it was like a, at one time, a bustling agricultural farm town, but everything had pulled out. It was, they'd literally pulled up the railroad tracks in this town. Wow. They're like gouged into the earth where the railroad tracks were. And there were all these abandoned buildings. And so the mayor of Richland, Georgia, went to them and said, you know, would you open a distillery in my town? And she said, no, there's nothing there. And he said, yeah, I know. I need something there. I need something that will have a tax base. And so they said, they came in, they looked at all these old buildings, and they said, okay, you know, we get these buildings really cheap, so let's do it. And so they have this big distillery now, and now they're actually attracting other business back to town. There's a chocolate maker that had come in. There was a brewery when I was there. There's somebody outside of town who's doing olive oil. You know, I mean,
wow.
I mean, there's industry coming back to Richland, Georgia because of this distillery, because people go there to experience it.
Wow.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I wanted to do this as a book was because a lot of the ways these people promote themselves and sell their product is through tours. And so, you know, it's not a book for just for bartenders. I'm hoping I hope the bartenders don't laugh at me for my information. I hope I got everything right. But it's really aimed at people who want to go out and experience something hands-on. I mean, it'll change how you ever look at a drink. When you go into a distillery and you stick your finger in the vat of corn and you get down to the end and where the parrot is and you see the actual liquor coming out and you can put your finger in that stream and taste it, you will never think about that liquor the same way again. You'll have like a personal relationship with it. And when you go to drink it, it's this very, you know, emotional sort of sense. All the distilleries are telling me about people who come in and want them to sign their bottles.
Wow.
Because they want to be able to go home and say, hey, you know, I met the guy, signed my bottle, and, you know, I was in the place where they grew this corn. People love that experience. And so that's why I wrote it as a tour book, so that you can go and do this. You can go see these people. I have a section in my book on mansplaining.
And I saw that.
The problem of mansplaining in distilleries.
Yeah.
There are a lot of women making, who are master distillers, who are the ones in their family who are actually doing the distilling. And they say that women have an advantage because our taste buds are different than men's. And so we can, physiologically, we can pick up more tastes sometimes than men do. But I heard from an awful lot of those distillers who told me, you know, a dealer will come in looking to sell them supplies and it'll be, oh, well, I need to speak to the distiller. Can you call your husband for me? And they just kind of go, oh, God, again, really? My husband and I were out touring one time and we noticed that if I asked a male distiller a question, they would turn and answer my husband. You know, we run into that all the time. People don't expect women to be involved in the alcohol industry, but we are.
Thanks again to our friend Sean Chavis for that great conversation with Kathleen Purvis. And one more time, her book, which you ought to buy, is called Distilling the South, A Guide to Southern Craft Liquors and the People Who Make Them. And when it comes to strong drink, Kathleen Purvis knows whereof she speaks, and I can prove it with a story of my own. The first time I met Kathleen, it was at a Southern Foodways Alliance conference in Birmingham, Alabama, and someone in the hotel lobby introduced us. We chatted for a few minutes, and then Kathleen asked me if I wanted to have a drink. I thought I was being invited over to the hotel's bar. Instead, Kathleen just looked at me, opened up her pocketbook, pulled out a flask, and handed it to me.